The Russian foreign minister says Western leaders should examine their own consciences before accusing President Vladimir Putin of committing war crimes in Ukraine. Palestine's health ministry says Israeli forces killed over 350 Palestinians in 2021, including about 90 children, while injuring more than 16,000 in the same period. Also ahead, Iran's foreign minister blames the pause in the Vienna talks to revive the JCPOA on the US's excessive demands, saying Tehran will never give in to such demands. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour is day 41 of the Russian military offensive against Ukraine, and here is a quick rundown of the main theater of war. The White House claims that Russia is shoring up its campaign in eastern Ukraine with probable plans to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers there. The U.S. says Russian forces are pulling away from Ukraine's capital, Kiev, in a shift towards the eastern regions. Ukrainian officials also say Russia is preparing for a big attack in the east and have urged mass evacuations in that region. Moscow says its drawdown near Kiev and the northern city of Chernihiv is a goodwill gesture to support peace talks. Ukraine and its allies say Russia was forced to shift its focus to eastern Ukraine after suffering heavy losses near Kiev. In the south, heavy fighting reportedly continues around the besieged city of Mariupol as Russian forces try to take the city. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team has not been able to reach Mariupol to evacuate civilians due to security conditions. That was the fourth attempt in as many days to reach the city. The Russian foreign minister says Western leaders should examine their own consciences before accusing President Vladimir Putin of committing war crimes in Ukraine. Lavrov's remarks came after earlier on Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for his Russian counterpart to be tried for what he called committing war crimes in the Ukrainian town of Bucha. Asked about Biden's comments, Lavrov said the West should first consider its own actions in Iraq and Libya. He said, quote, "Not all is well with the conscience of American politicians." Separately, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Washington will consult with its allies about Russia's accountability. Sullivan said the case of alleged incidents in Bucha could be referred to the International Criminal Court. Kiev claims the recently found mass graves in Bucha and other areas near the capital contain bodies of hundreds of civilians executed by Russian troops. Moscow points the accusing finger at Ukraine, saying it has fabricated images of dead civilians to smear the image of Russia. Tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine take a new turn as France says it has decided to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. A French diplomatic source says the country will expel 35 Russian personnel with diplomatic status. The French foreign ministry also says the activities of Russian diplomats were considered contrary to security interests of Paris. The move was part of a wider European initiative after Germany announced it expelled 40 Russian diplomats. The German foreign minister described the move as a response to what she called the unbelievable brutality Russia had unleashed in Ukraine. Moscow has denounced Berlin's move, calling it an unfriendly act which would worsen bilateral ties. The Kremlin has also vowed to respond to Germany's move. Earlier, Lithuania said it expelled the Russian ambassador and would recall its envoy in Moscow. Let's go back to our earlier story regarding the Russian foreign minister who says Western leaders should examine their own consciences before accusing President Vladimir Putin of committing war crimes in Ukraine. This comes in the aftermath of the incidents, alleged incidents in the city of Bucha, where apparently the bodies of civilians were found. Let's bring in Scott Bennett. He's a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer. Scott, you know, shouldn't we, from a logical point of view, shouldn't we, firstly, the West, I mean, first of all, try and seek the exact incident, what happened, you know, what's the nature of the incident before trying to get or accusing Russia of war crimes?
Well, that's what you would do if you're interested in the truth, if you're interested in the facts, but that is not what Ukraine, the British, or the Americans are interested in. They're interested in psychological warfare and propaganda. That's why the British have held up any inquiry into this incident at the United Nations Security Council, most likely because the British know that they'll be found out to having been involved. The British were instrumental in the White Helmet theatrical operations in Syria, where they would pretend that individuals were wounded or killed, and they were found to be crisis actors. So the British are very well aware that they are most likely going to be exposed as creating this propaganda. They've already been exposed as having Polish film crews hiring actors to pretend that there's all sorts of chaos. And of course, the United States is desperate to try and provoke some sort of international outrage against Russia. So it is no doubt that this is completely fabricated, dramatic, and it fits the perfect model that NATO has always pursued. They did this in Libya as well, when they invented a city in Qatar and pretended that it was Tripoli, and did filming of operations there, pretending it was in Libya when it was not. They've also filmed fake beheadings in studios with cameras and studio lights, pretending that it was done in the desert in Libya when it was not. So the British and the United States, the MI6 and the CIA, the Mossad and the Israelis are all notorious for their lies and propaganda. They trade in it like, you know, it's oxygen to them. So I think Russia is very well aware of it, and they are not going to be falling into any of these traps. They do need to amplify the truth and raise it up and declare that this war is not something that they are going to back down from. This is an existential threat towards Russia, and right, for that reason, they're looking to save as many civilians as they can.
Scott, just in the 1 or 2 minutes that we have left, you know, we don't know for a fact where, if those dead bodies were, if they were the victims of Russian troops or other factors that may have played a part. We don't know until there is an investigation to find out the truth. So why not, as the Russian foreign minister said, bring a UN Security Council meeting, or even take the case to the ICC. But in the same case, when you hear the US National Security Advisor saying that this case should go to the ICC, there are many cases in Iraq where the America-led invasion killed more than a million civilians, and in Libya, where NATO killed so many civilians and so many terrorists emerged. Shouldn't those cases also be taken to the ICC?
Absolutely. Those are the cases that would most likely show that the United States and Saudi Arabia and Israel launched this crusade across the Middle East based on the fake false flag attacks of 9/11. So Afghanistan was invaded based on a theatrical invention that the US CIA, Mossad, and the Saudi Arabian intelligence services did in New York. They also used that to expand into Iraq using the same bioweapons labs theatrics, with Colin Powell holding up a vial of dust. That same bioweapons lab actually has been found in Ukraine, and it was part of Metabiota, the Global Viral Forecasting Institute, with ties to Hunter Biden, which has ties to Joe Biden, his father, the fake president of the United States. And that also has ties to the COVID-19 scamdemic, with the animal-to-human transmission. And the real bioweapons crimes against humanity was in the West trying to acquire Russian DNA for muscular skeletal study in order to deploy aerosol bioweapons against the Russians. The Russians knew about this. That's where the real genocide and crime against humanity should be heard, in the International Criminal Court. And Russia most likely will bring that. And that's why this distraction operation is being launched. The West knows that the only way that it can survive is to create false flag attacks, fake shootings, false genocide, false war crimes, but the evidence is not there to support it, and it is part and parcel to their typical strategy of using lies and propaganda and without any semblance of fact or the truth.
Scott, thank you very much indeed for your time. Scott Bennett there, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joining us live out of San Francisco. Now, tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine take a new turn as France says it has decided to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. A French diplomatic source says the country will expel 35 Russian personnel with diplomatic status. The French Foreign Ministry also said the activities of Russian diplomats were considered contrary to security interests of Paris. The decision was part of a wider European initiative after Germany announced it expelled 40 Russian diplomats. The German foreign minister described the move as a response to what she called the unbelievable brutality Russia had unleashed in Ukraine. Moscow has denounced Berlin's move, calling it an unfriendly act, which would worsen bilateral ties. The Kremlin has also vowed to respond to Germany's move. Earlier, Lithuania said it expelled the Russian ambassador and would recall its envoy in Moscow. Tensions in the occupied Palestinian territories have increased dramatically over the past few days. The escalation has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan, and as customary, restrictions to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque have been one of the reasons behind the clashes. In the latest development, Palestinians were attacked as they gathered for night prayers in occupied East Al-Quds.
The holy month of Ramadan has begun for Muslims around the world. However, some struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. Palestinians are facing a new round of escalations while being subjected to a blockade. The number of Palestinians killed so far this week has reached 10. The Gaza Strip-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the West Bank-headquartered Palestinian Authority have slammed the Israeli regime over its earlier targeted killing of Palestinian youths. In a statement, Palestinian presidential spokesman Nabil Abu Radena said the ongoing escalation would blow up the situation in Palestine and the entire region. This came after Israel's occupation forces shot dead three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday, amid the escalation of Israeli violence in the Palestinian territories. Israeli forces assassinated the trio by opening fire on their vehicle near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. They later seized the vehicle and the bodies of the three people. Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, identified the victims as its members. Palestinian resistance groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas have vowed that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished.
If the Israelis see Ramadan as an opportunity when Palestinians, especially Palestinians who are associated with resistance groups, if they see this as an opportunity for them to be gathered with their families, then they become targets, and their families become targets. So this is unfortunately something for the Israelis. This may be considered an opportunity to be more repressive than usual.
Palestinians were brutally attacked by Israeli regime forces at the Damascus Gate of the occupied Al-Quds on the second night of the holy month of Ramadan as well. It is customary for Israeli forces to exhibit increased levels of violence against Palestinians gathering in the area during the fasting month of Ramadan. At least 20 Palestinians were injured in the clashes and 10 were detained.
Turning elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister blames the pause in the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA on Washington's excessive demands. Hossein Amir Abdullahian stressed that Iran will never yield to such U.S. demands. The top diplomat noted that an agreement over the restoration of the JCPOA is achievable if the White House behaves realistically. He also said The foreign ministry acts with logic and power to observe the country's red lines. Iran has said these red lines pertain to the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again. Pakistan's Supreme Court adjourns without ruling on Prime Minister Imran Khan's decision to dissolve parliament amid the opposition's attempt to hold a no-confidence vote to oust him. The top court has delayed its decision until Tuesday. Both the government and the opposition filed lawsuits and petitions after the Deputy Speaker of Parliament refused to allow a debate on the no-confidence motion on Sunday. The political crisis deepened after Khan asked the presidency to dissolve the National Assembly and call a snap election. A joint opposition called the decision unconstitutional. Khan's cabinet has been dissolved as well in anticipation of fresh elections. The Prime Minister is accused of failing to revive the economy and cracking down on corruption. Earlier, we were joined by our Islamabad correspondent, Kamran Yusuf. He explains how a decision by the top court on whether to uphold the president's actions would shape politics in Pakistan.
If the Supreme Court of Pakistan declares that the action of the deputy speaker was unconstitutional, then we will have to restart again from Sunday when the vote of no confidence was presented before the National Assembly. But if the Supreme Court of Pakistan adjudicates that now this is a new reality, the National Assembly has been dissolved and Prime Minister has already called for early elections, then of course the next step would be the setting up of a caretaker government, because under the Pakistani constitution, elections are held under the interim government. But of course, that it all depends on the Supreme Court of Pakistan, that how it views the action taken by the Deputy Speaker and also Prime Minister Imran Khan on Sunday. Today, there were expectations that the Supreme Court might announce some kind of verdict, but then the Chief Justice of Pakistan said, since this is a very important issue and they would not like to give judgment in haste or in the air, they want to listen all the relevant political parties before making any announcement.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In actuality, it is the Palestinian existence that is in real jeopardy, says Ramzi Bar, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Gaza's forthcoming crisis might be worse than anything we have ever seen. Stay tuned for more. The water is back, one family member would announce in a mix of excitement and panic, often very late at night. The tactic of holding Palestinians hostage to the Zionist regime's water charity was so widespread during the first Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, to the extent that denying water supplies to targeted refugee camps, villages, towns, or whole regions was the first measure taken to subdue the rebellious population. This was often followed by military raids, mass arrests, and deadly violence, but it almost always began with cutting Palestinians off from their water supplies. The Zionist regime's water war on the Palestinians has changed since those early days, especially as the climate change crisis has accelerated the Zionist regime's need to prepare for grim future possibilities. Of course, this largely happens at the expense of the occupied Palestinians. In the West Bank, the Zionist regime continues to usurp Palestinian water resources from the region's main aquifers, the mountain aquifer and the coastal aquifer. Frustratingly, the Zionist regime's main water company, Mekorot, sells stolen Palestinian water to Palestinian villages and towns, especially in the northern West Bank region, at exorbitant prices. Aside from the ongoing profiteering from water theft, the Zionist regime continues to use water as a form of collective punishment in the West Bank, while quite often denying Palestinians, especially in Area C, the right to dig new wells to circumvent the Zionist regime water monopoly. According to Amnesty International, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank consume on average 73 liters of water a day per person. Compare this to an Israeli citizen who consumes approximately 240 liters of water a day, and even worse, to an illegal Israeli Jewish settler who consumes over 300 liters per day. The Palestinian share of water is not only far below the average consumed by Israelis, but is even below the recommended daily minimum of 100 liters per capita, as designated by the World Health Organization. As difficult as the situation for West Bank Palestinians is, in Gaza, the humanitarian catastrophe is already in effect. On the occasion of World Water Day on March 22nd, Gaza's Water and Environmental Quality Authority warned of a massive crisis should Gaza's water supplies continue to deplete at the current dangerous rate. The authority's spokesman, Mazan Albana, told reporters that 98% of Gaza's water supplies are not fit for human consumption. The consequences of this terrifying statistic are well known to Palestinians and, in effect, to international community as well. Last October, Mohammad Shahada of Euromed Monitor told the 48th UN Human Rights Council session that about one quarter of all diseases in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and that an estimated 12% of deaths among Gaza's children are linked to intestinal infections related to contaminated water. But how did Gaza get to this point? On May 25th, 4 days after the end of the latest Zionist regime war on Gaza, the charity Oxfam announced that 400,000 people in besieged Gaza have had no access to regular water supplies. The reason is that the Zionist regime military campaigns always begin with the targeting of Palestinian electric grids, water services, and other vital public facilities. According to Oxfam, 11 days of bombardment severely impacted the three main desalination plants in Gaza City. It is important to keep in mind that the water crisis in Gaza has been ongoing for years, and every aspect of this protracted crisis is linked to the Zionist regime. With damaged or ailing infrastructure, much of Gaza's water contains dangerously high salinity levels or is extremely polluted by sewage and other reasons. Even before the Zionist regime redeployed its forces out of Gaza in 2005 to impose a siege on the Strip's population from land, sea and air, Gaza had a water crisis. Gaza's coastal aquifer was entirely controlled by the Zionist regime military, which diverted quality water to the few thousand Jewish settlers, while occasionally allocating high saline water to the then 1.5 million Palestinian people, granted that Palestinians did not protest or resist the Zionist regime occupation in any way. Nearly 17 years later, Gaza's population has grown to 2.1 million, and Gaza's already struggling aquifer is in a far worse shape. The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, reported that water from Gaza's aquifer is depleting due to over-extraction because people have no other choice. UNICEF added, worse pollution and an influx of seawater mean that only 4% of the aquifer water is fit to drink. The rest must be purified and desalinated to make it drinkable. In other words, Gaza's problem is not the lack of access to existing fresh water reserves, as the latter simply do not exist or are rapidly depleting, but the lack of technology and fuel that would give Palestinians in Gaza the ability to make their water nominally drinkable. Even that is not a long-term solution. The Zionist regime is doing its utmost to destroy any Palestinian chances at recovery from this ongoing crisis. More, it seems that Tel Aviv is only invested in making the situation worse to jeopardize Palestinian chances of survival. For example, last year, Palestinians accused the Zionist regime of deliberately flooding thousands of Palestinian dunams in Gaza when it vented its southern dams, which the Zionist regime uses to collect rainwater. The almost yearly ritual by the Zionist regime continues to devastate Gaza's ever-shrinking farming areas, the backbone of Palestinian survival under the Zionist regime hermetic siege. The international community often pays attention to Gaza during times of the Zionist regime wars. And even then, the attention is mostly negative, where Palestinians are usually accused of provoking the Zionist regime's supposed wars. The truth is that, even when the Zionist regime's military campaigns end, Tel Aviv continues to wage war on the Gaza Strip's inhabitants. In actuality, it is the Palestinian existence that is in real jeopardy. When almost all of Gaza's water is not fit for human consumption because of a deliberate Zionist regime strategy, one can understand why Palestinians continue to fight back as if their lives are dependent on it, because they are. IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Qasim and Shaykh Ali Himani. Shaykh Ali Himani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome, brother. And Shaykh Qasim, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about a very good and important topic. Should children use a smartphone without parental supervision? Especially during COVID-19 pandemic, we could see that the use of smartphones, especially for the children, in both primary schools, you know, and upper schools, is more than before. So, it is inevitable nowadays, in fact, not to use smartphones, but it had its own impacts on the lives of both parents and the children, the relation between parents and children, and so on. But the content in which, you know, with which the children are now concerned is really dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be that for some countries there is a warning or a threat at the very beginning or rating for that, but they do not work at all.
Yeah. It's true that the parents are working with the phone all the time due to this pandemic. They're busy working and all that. And I had this problem with my 7-year-old daughter. She would see me on the phone all the time because I'm interacting with people across the globe. They're reaching me out for counseling and all that stuff. Sometimes I'm supporting some organizations from the intellectual point of view that make sure your work is within the boundaries of Islam and all that. So, and we used to tell her that don't use mobile phones. So she would come to me and say, Baba, you're using mobile phone. Why can't I use it? Immediately, I would show her the screen. Look, I'm working. Then I explain it to her that, look, this person is having ABCD problem and I'm trying to answer him. See? And I read the content for her. And then they were, it's like she would, inspect me at random times. She would just come, she's playing, she would come running and say, Baba, why can't I use the phone? Then I'm like, look, okay. I'm helping. I'm making a PowerPoint presentation because I have to go and record.
Okay.
I have to do a presentation here. I have a class, so I'm putting in my notes on philosophy and mantak. And she would say, oh. Then she realized that Baba uses the phone for educational purposes, for work purposes, for something that is productive and not for wasting time. And I had my, you know, cousins and their children come over. Their children would constantly come to me. They would see my phone. It's different than his father's phone. He'd say, can I play a game? Then I turn it on and give it to them and say, I don't have games in my phone. If you can find one, play. They would go through my phone and they would find only important, you know, dictionaries and all that stuff. And they're like, oh yeah, your phone doesn't have games. This is something that the parents can do.
Yeah.
Restrict the children from downloading games from Google Play or put a lock on Google Play itself and have only important stuff. Then the children also realize that this is not an entertainment unit. This is a unit for productivity. Right?
The good news about my smartphone is that it does not support any game, you know.
Okay. Android 4 version.
Android 3, 4. Okay, it does not. And whenever my child comes to me and say, Baba, give me my phone, you know, I give it to him just messages and phone call and nothing else. You know, the case is that the children have to understand that playing and game, you know, the true place for game and are not smartphones, but that's the world outside, okay? To get outside, to get into the park, play football, biking, something like that, you know? And this is a problem because nowadays unwanted obesity among the children, especially in the primary school, you know, limiting the creative minds among the people and also the mental health and also the behavioral problems that are here and there are lots of, there's a long list of the problems that are made by the smartphones nowadays. And I think day by day it's being aggravated, isn't it?
Actually, I believe that I can add another suggestion to the way that parents can, you know, behave towards their children, to what the Sheikh actually mentioned. The other thing is, we can have, you know, together activities, you know. So at some certain times, you know, I don't know, at night or I don't know.
Family time.
Yeah, family time. So quality time. We would get together and play with, you know, with our children. And, you know, and this is what the psychologists say, that, you know, the less the children are active, really, you know, in the real world with the real games, the less their intelligence progress. So this is unfortunately the problem that we have. This is research on this, that the problem solving skills diminished during the time that the smartphones are used, you know, by the children.
Correct.
Because the reason is that the problem solving skills, they are coming out of, you know, activities. So
and physical activities, right? Not the screen based activities.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, that would be another maybe way in order for, you know, putting the mobile phones aside and, you know, be with our children.
You know, some of the parents make this excuse, which Sheikh Qasim has pointed out, that, you know, I'm giving my son this phone with, you know, some very nice intellectual games in it, you know, solving puzzles and, you know, building blocks and, you know,
algorithm, creative games,
which is going to lead and increase his creativity and all that. But that's not true. I agree to a certain extent that it helps, but one has to understand that the screen time has its own negative impact on the child. My daughter comes running to me saying that, you know, ex-cousin has a mobile phone and, you know, I want one too, or I want to play on the phone. And I'm like, what is she playing on that phone? Then she said, you know, solving puzzles, putting things together to make. I said, no worries. I'll go out and buy a physical puzzle for you. And then I buy a physical puzzle to her, though it costs me a little more, because on the app I can get it for free, but here it costs me money, but I'm okay with that. So I sit with her and I play puzzle with her. The benefit she gets is that she gets to own a toy, which she can show to others that I have an X puzzle, which is ABCD, whatever. And then she gets quality time from the father sitting with her and trying to solve. So there's bonding happening. There's learning happening. There is motor skills happening, hands movement, eye coordination and all that, which doesn't happen in the mobile phone. So true that you might have to shell some money out of your pocket, but for everything that's available on internet, which is productive, you have a physical game available. Why not opt for that physical game rather than, you know, just going to your mobile phone and downloading an app? It has its own flaws and challenges.
Smartphones were created in order to connect people, but now people are disconnected from each other because of the smartphones, you know. And, you know, the sad news is about the fake recognition that it makes out of yourself, your personality. You know that on social media and social networks, what's happening? The wrong fake profiles that the people are making, you know, following this, following that. And a world is shaped around you, which has no benefit for this world and your hereafter. Because, of course, there are some good uses out of the smartphones or the tablets or some, you know, special softwares, applications. They are good, really good, you know. For example, how to memorize the Quran, reading a hadith, or it's made the search really easier to do. Yes. But the case is that the world that is made around you, the fake artificial made that is made around you, you know, you talked about artificial intelligence. Now it is changed into augmented reality and intelligence, which is really, really, you know, harmful. A kind of world that you play in, that you have role, but this is not you, and this is not your talents and your capabilities. I think it's really dangerous.
I think we can look at the whole concept of technology from two points, two perspectives, you know, using it productively and, you know, causing harm to yourself.
Okay.
Like you mentioned, I can have a Quran app on my phone and I can use the app to memorize Quran, which is using the phone for productive purposes. Yes. Similarly, using augmented reality or virtual reality for productive purposes. If you've heard of this app that was created called VR Karbala, virtual reality Karbala, and then they had this virtual reality episode of Karbala designed that, you know, Bainul Haramain, they gave these glasses to people wear and watch that what happened in Karbala and where are you standing right now. This is the Qatlagah, this happened, and it actually impacted them and made their iman stronger, right? On the other hand, the same augmented reality and virtual reality is being used in metaverse and other places and some games where it is leading to harmful ideologies, and some sexual content is also being promoted through VR and AR, yes. Right? So it's in the hands of the person to a certain extent where, you know, the taqwa, the piety of the person plays a vital role in deciding that what do I want to use the phone or my laptop or my tablet for.
In the past, the people used to do or commit a sin through the physical things usually. Now it's a digital sin, you know. And through this digital sin, so many, we can say, talents, I mean the religious, spiritual talents of the people are being destroyed. And the age is now really low because... When you talk about the children in the house and having a smartphones, having no control or supervision over them from the side of the parents, and the schools are also, you know, have role. Schools have role in order to teach the children how to use them. Unfortunately, it is not the case because they made a kind of private world for you. You have a privacy, and when whoever wants to enter this privacy is violating it. So he's doing something wrong. And the laws and the notices are all based on these privacy. Can we solve this problem, Sheikh Hassan?
Yeah, actually, I believe that I have referred again to the concept that I introduced at the beginning of this show, which is the media literacy. You know, this is something that is so much important. That you know, we have to work on this concept and, you know, to based on Islam, the teachings of Islam, especially, we have to have this, you know, regulations for this virtual life that we live in social media or in the, you know, in the media as a whole. So that is something that has to be taken so seriously.
Yes.
Let me just add another problem that people may experience during actually making use of this smartphones and social media, which is the fake profile, you know, the fake IDs, that is sort of, you know, that
fake
it gives...
Fake identities.
Identity.
Yeah. That's that upon a very sensitive point here.
Yeah, that's, I believe that actually makes a lot of problems, one of which is, you know, a sort of hypocrisy, you know, ingraining some hypocrisy in that person that is using that fake identity, that he or she feels that it's possible that I sort of create another identity and I live by that the identity and I can do whatever I want with that.
A totally different person.
Yeah.
Living a digital life, which is totally different compared to the real life.
Yeah. And then when this person comes to the real life, you know, he or she for sure has been impacted by that,
exactly.
You know, that feelings that he has or she had, you know, in that fake
world,
identity that he or
there's
she
nothing,
had.
You know, the rate of studying nowadays is low. The people do not read books or, you know, the good content does not come to their mind because the people out of the social media only learn one sentence or one notice or one piece of advice and they see, they know. And this type of search, you know, search for the true knowledge has been given away from the people.
Yeah.
The people are searching for this and that, the news of the celebrities,
something like that,
you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately. Okay, that's right. Today's children are the next generation, you know, next adults of the next generation, and we have to take care of them. For sure, Islam and the religion of Islam has some good pieces of advice for social etiquettes and the family life. Inshallah, have chance to use them in our life and apply them.
Inshallah.
Not a preacher without practice. Inshallah.
Inshallah.
Okay. Thank you, Sheikh Qasim
and
Sheikh Ali Himani for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you without you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light, it guides me through my darkest nights, it shows me right from wrong in life. World that often lies, 'cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The annual report of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights into human rights violations in Palestine and other occupied Palestinian territories is a damning indictment of Zionist Israel. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ayman Ahmad, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Report Confirms Israeli Apartheid. Here's the story. The annual report of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, UNHCHR, into human rights violations in Palestine and other occupied Palestinian territories is a damning indictment of Zionist Israel. Authored by Michael Link, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories Occupied since 1967, the report concludes that it satisfies the prevailing evidentiary standard for the existence of apartheid. Michael Link is Professor of International Human Rights Law at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. He introduced his report to Human Rights Council on March 24th. It covers the period between November 1st, 2020 and October 31st, 2021. It addresses issues relating to accountability for alleged violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law committed by all relevant duty bearers in the occupied Palestinian territory, OPT. These include the West Bank, including East Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip. The report also examines measures taken against human rights defenders and civil society actors, documenting violations and advocating for accountability by all duty bearers. The present report draws on human rights monitoring conducted by the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in OPT and information from government sources, other UN entities and non-governmental organizations. OHCHR requested the Zionist regime to provide information by November 15, 2021, on any accountability measures adopted during the reporting period in relation to violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law committed in the OPT. The Zionist regime, through its contemptuous nature, did not respond despite being the most egregious violator of human rights. The UN report follows on the publication of similar findings of the Zionist regime's apartheid by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, and Israeli human rights organizations B'Tselem, Yeshdin, and many other international and regional human rights organizations. The UN report found that the human rights situation for Palestinians deteriorated during the reporting period. The Zionist regime occupation forces increased the use of live ammunition in the West Bank, including East Al-Quds, together with intensification of settler-related violence. These patterns resulted in an increase in the number of Palestinians killed and injured. The Zionist regime occupation forces killed 315 Palestinians, including 197 men, 41 women and 77 children, and injured 17,597 Palestinians, including at least 527 women and 1,472 children during the reporting period. In the context of Israeli attacks on Gaza, OHCHR monitoring continued to indicate insufficient respect for international humanitarian law by the Zionist regime. Beyond direct hostilities, OHCHR documented numerous cases that raise concerns about the Zionist regime's respect as the occupying power for international humanitarian law in the context of occupation and by all duty bearers with regard to their international humanitarian law and obligations. Many incidents of the use of force raised serious concerns that its use was excessive, in some cases amounting to arbitrary deprivation of life, including extrajudicial execution. The UN report found a climate of impunity of the Zionist regime troops that has persisted since 1967. Referring to the Zionist regime's 11-day onslaught on Gaza from May 10th to 21st, 2021, the UN report describes it as the most significant escalation in hostilities between the Zionist regime and Palestinian groups in Gaza since 2014. According to the UN, 261 Palestinians were killed, including 153 men, 41 women, and 67 children, including 23 girls and 44 boys. At least 130 of those killed were civilians. About 2,200 other Palestinians were injured, including about 685 children and 480 women. OHCHR documented a number of incidents in which the Zionist regime attacks having resulted in significant civilian casualties and damages to civilian objects might have violated international humanitarian law principles of distinction, proportionally and feasibly precautious. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reported that it had submitted 57 criminal complaints to the military attorney general of the Zionist regime and 295 civil complaints to the compensation office of the Ministry of War of the Zionist regime in relation to incidents involving the killing of 101 Palestinians and the injury of another 100 during the hostilities in May 2021. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, the military advocate general of the Zionist regime had indicated that 11 of those complaints had been referred for further examination to the General Staff Mechanism for Fact-Finding Assessments, established in 2014. OHCHR expressed serious concern that despite preliminary examinations carried out by the Zionist regime in some cases, the findings regarding possible violations have been shielded from public scrutiny and do not appear to have yet triggered the opening of criminal investigations or any other meaningful accountability steps. The UN report cites an artillery attack on May 13, 2021, against a residential neighborhood and agricultural area adjacent to the Gaza-occupied territory's fence near Beit Lahia. 6 Palestinians were killed, including a 17-year-old girl and a 9-month-old infant, and several others were injured. The report said the incident raises serious concerns of its compatibility with the prohibition of indiscriminate and disproportionate attacks under international humanitarian law. Despite such clear evidence of the Zionist regime's crimes, Western regimes still have to gall to defend this racist entity.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.